Chairman, friends. It's been fascinating listening to the questions and answers. It's been most helpful and illuminating. Quite obviously, you've been taking it as what is sometimes called the nuts and bolts approach. But knowing Brinsley of old and knowing Contact a little bit, I had thought and still think that tonight we're taking it a little deeper. I hope that's right. If not, we'll come back to nuts and bolts and for the honest people there who are not yet convinced of the realities of them. Let's do a quick recap, but not sightings, because there have been hundreds of those, not even landings. 1947, the expression is born, flying saucers, always popularized. And there are curious things about it. I mentioned this last time, but let's recap. You see, there is a businessman, Kenneth Arnold, flying his own plane. He sees these saucers. And that's one level at which we can look. Because he's a businessman and he's a pilot, well, that adds validity to his report, and we can leave it at that. Because he's a successful businessman, sufficiently successful to own his own plane, well, that appeals to, subconsciously or otherwise, and we can leave it at that. Where did he see this? He saw it at Mount Rainier, Washington. Well, what's peculiar about that? Well, a mountain in allegory is usually depictive of spirit as distinct from the valley of matter. I think these other inner planes are very much the part of saucers, and we just noticed that. It was Mount Rainier, Washington. What's peculiar about Mount Rainier? It's got three peaks. In the exoteric allegories of all the scriptures of most of the peoples going back thousands of years, if you're stuck in nuts and bolts, millions of years, if you'll accept Atlantis and Lemuria, either way, the Trinity is in the subconscious of millions of people. So you've got a mountain and there's Trinity. How many sources were there? Never mind about their speed, all of which has been described, and their shape, and their this and their that. How many were there? There were nine. Nine in numerology is the number of initiation and trial, not the ten of perfection. And I don't think many of us here would claim that humanity in its growth has reached perfection. It's more in the realm of trial. Perfection is still for tomorrow. The bombs and the disturbances are of today. So you've got these nine sources. You've got a mountain. You've got three peaks. What time was it? 3 p.m. When was it? 24th of June, 1947. What's special about that? It was midsummer. Well, why midsummer? People are saying, do you see them in the day? The reports I've seen, which run into, I think, thousands, if not tens of thousands, as many are in day as by night. But why June? It's the high peak of summer, June the 24th, the longest day has just come, the most of the solar forces, least of the lunar forces. What was happening at the time? 3 p.m., again another trinity. It was a conjunction of planets. Which planets? Jupiter, the higher mind consciousness. Venus, this love wisdom aspect. Venusian sources. June the 24th, June the 6th month, 6th, the keynote of the new age, sixth sense. 24, the double 12, the 12 hours of the day, the 12 signs of the zodiac, the 12 apostles. I'm beginning to lose some of the audience. Why? Where along this line is the prejudice beginning to strike? Have you been taught that's of the devil, that's of superstition, that's of something else? Are you not beginning to look? Are all these things coincidences? June the 24th, the double 12, the positive and the negative, so-called day, so-called night, so-called good, so-called evil. 1947, added up, comes to 21, 3/7. Why all these things? Which level are you going to take sources? Are you just stuck with a successful businessman seeing something in the sky? Or where along the line does prejudice begin to draw in? Are you scientific? I'm proud of it. And all this is superstition. Are you religious and proud of it, of a particular one? And if you bring in something like numerology of the devil or something, does that hold you back? This is the sort of way we might look at sources. Because we're all in this. The whole village, planet Earth. And it doesn't matter which bit of the village you live in. East, west, north, south, black, blue, yellow, green, who cares? That tiny little village, do you think it's important? 1,000 million planets said to be inhabited, even by nuts and bolts. We've been on this little village, it said, some 80 millions of years. Ockham date is a little longer. Let's take 80 million. A couple of centuries ago, that's damn all in time, the fastest speed was a horse. And suddenly we've got Apollo whatnot. Now, supposing in the 80 millions, somebody else has been around for 80 millions, and they're 10% more advanced than we are. Just 10%. 10% of 80 millions is roughly 8 millions. 8 million years. 800 millennia. And a couple of centuries ago, we'd got a horse. So there's a lot more in this flying saucer business than a couple of nuts and a couple of bolts and a telescope. There are 1,000 million planets. They're not all going to be stuck with our three dimensions. They're not all going to be stuck like we are. Some of us. So which way along the line of that flying saucer sighting of June the 24th, 1947, do you start saying nonsense? And the big question is, not the nonsense, but you. Why you, at that moment, are drawing in? Because the other bloke goes on. What's wrong with you? Where does fear, lack of knowledge of the safe, the three dimensions, space-time continuum, where does the unknown begin to hold you back? That's how I look at sources. Let's look at it another way, from 1947 to now. For the first 7 years, why it should be seven, tell me. 1947 to 54, there's open discussion. You look at any newspaper, in Chinese, in Urdu, in English, in Turkish, in American, in Russian, pick any newspaper around the village. All the front pages during those 7 years have got stories of flying saucers. This is a statement anybody with a few hours' work in the public library can check for themselves. Suddenly in 54, down comes the night and the saucers vanish off the front pages. This is extraordinary. 1954, Stalin had just died a couple of years before. The Berlin blockade was just over. The Cold War was a big item. Everybody had got a gun, which they were pointing at everybody else. Nobody was talking to anybody else in the village. We were having a whale of a time in our usual earthling way. Yet in 1954, the Chinese, the Russians, the English, the Germans, the lot, all took sources off their front pages. It is a staggering fact. That it is a fact, each can prove for himself with a bit of work. And how could such a thing happen? I mean, we're quite happy to say the other chap's got a censored press. If we say the Russians have got a censored press, everybody claps here. If you go to Moscow and say the imperialistic warmongering, I've forgotten quite the phrases of all the things, everybody claps there. You sit here, you say the Chinese and the Russians and the Americans and the English all gave the same treatment to sources in 1954. It is staggering. Usually in 54, the focus is on something else. Do you remember Mead Lane, that researcher? He went beyond nuts and bolts. He died recently, but he was a good bloke. And in 54, he circulated his round robin, as it was called, saying that he'd had news of this stupendous event, which was so stupendous, so dramatic, so unbelievable, so all these adjectives, that at any rate he was circulating it round right now in case his magazine was stopped like Bender's was. We all know Bender's magazine, Space Review, was stopped in April 53. He said, I've got it, I've got it, I've got it. I'll tell you in the next quarterly issue, which is July. Quarterly issue of July said, I'm so sorry. And September issue closed it down. And Mead Lane sent this round post haste. Many people had. The story was that at Edwards Air Force Base, by invitation, by prior arrangement with the government, five sources landed, stayed several hours, and allowed the scientists to sniff all over them. And the sources would materialize, dematerialize, make themselves visible, invisible, all these things which sightings show. When you see a thing in the sky in daylight, and suddenly it's not there. It's not, it's gone away, or into a distance behind a cloud. It's not there. Do you remember Captain Speakman's report? BOAC, BEA pilot, flying scheduled flight to Schiphol. A magnificent report, you know, cumulus clouds so many feet, bearing so many degrees north, altitude so and so, visibility unlimited. He and the co-pilot see this UFO. The UFO prevents him contacting base on his radar because the contact breakers break. And the report of Captain Speakman goes on, that total electrical failure on a modern aircraft nowadays is rare. In our case, we couldn't understand it because we were not using all our equipment, electrical equipment. When the UFO left, our contact breakers did stay in. Is it too much to ask that the UFO prevented us doing this? And the characteristic of the UFO, which when it maneuvered round the plane, described both by the pilot and the co-pilot, beautiful day, visibility unlimited, was that it was a luminous thing, and then suddenly it wasn't there. Speakman's words are, we suddenly became aware we were looking at an empty sky. This is what the sources landed at Edwards Air Force Base were doing. Were visible, not visible, dense physical, and allow you to walk through. Well, this is absolute nonsense in physics. Dense physical and you can walk through. It's all right and all that psychic stuff, but not in physics. And one of the gods we worship is physics. Or science. Any fool knows that this dense physical is dense physical. We've been taught it. It's our experience, we know. And yet we also know now that it's a moving mass of matter to which we've given fancy names like mesons and whatnots, and there's more space in that than there is solidity. So at which level are we going to have a look at sources? 1954, they disappear off the newspapers. They haven't disappeared from the village planet Earth because sightings go on. 1954, they said to have landed. How could you keep such a thing secret? And yet, the driblets come up. From the top echelons come salvos of ridicule. Nonsense, you stupid lot. There was no landing. From the middle ranges of the thing come, well, you couldn't keep a thing like that secret, could you? And from the lower ranges come masses of little driblets of information. Eisenhower suddenly slips out of Washington to go for a golfing holiday, inverted commas, at Palm Springs, next to Edwards Air Force Base. And his valet notices afterwards he'd forgotten to take his golf clubs. Little people who've gone out from the base to do a job, ordinary routine job, they've done it dozens of times, they come back to the base, it's sealed off, they're not allowed in. Did you know me? I'm so-and-so. Not allowed in. People who were sort of in the mess and heard conversations afterwards, people who were on the base and saw these things, or said they saw. Anyway, whatever it was in 54, whether it was that or whether it was not, the stuff did disappear off the headlines, off the front pages. And you got the next scheduled bit, which was silence, who just pretended sources weren't there. And yet people went on saying them. And people like our good selves here came to little meetings for no reason, no authority, no big name, nothing. Just come because you felt there was something there. And more and more and more, and the silence was beginning to crumble as we began whispering to each other, talking to each other. We'd seen it, we'd quite sure it wasn't this, it wasn't that, we'd our cousin and whatnot. And the crescendo began to grow. So you got the next bit, ridicule. And we've all seen the newspapers, and we've all suffered from it, ridicule. You saw a saucer, you were fool, nutcase, drunk, crank, anything like that. And the ridicule hurt, and it kept us quiet for quite a while. Then we began whispering again to each other, friends to friends. You know I'm not nutty, but honestly I saw. And he said, here's the photographs, because there have been lots of photographs. Another of the big myths is that they're all fake Ford hubcaps. It just doesn't stand investigation or truth. And films. Plenty of films. And again, oh, it's all fakeness, this won't stand up. And the ridicule began to grow thin. Too many people, like Captain Speakman, you couldn't ridicule him. Captain Howard of BOAC, flying across the Atlantic, he and the co-pilot, his air hostess, and his passengers, see this darn saucer for about 20 minutes. And he draws sketches of it when he comes down. It's a solid object, yes. You've got a good RAF record, Captain Howard, yes. You're now a BOAC pilot on a big plane. It's a responsible job, yes. And it was a solid object. What's the shape of it? He's drawn these shapes. Shapes, plural, solid object. Yes, it was a solid object, but it changed shape. Why, don't be silly. Any fool in physics knows that a solid object doesn't change shape. This was solid. those saucers landed at Edwards Air Force Base were visible and invisible. You could walk through them or you couldn't. So you come up against another joke. As we did in the 1947 story, where did you stop? And in solid objects changing shape, where do you stop? So you'd say, Captain Howard, you had a good record, you're still flying the plane, and we still love you, but you were mistaken. Sincere, but etc., etc. And we go on to the next stage. We've had open discussion, we've had silence, we've had ridicule, and we've slung old Speakman and Howard in the dustbin. It's much easier than re-looking at ourselves or re-looking at physics. And we go on to the next stage. All right, it's very difficult to throw the Howards and the Speaksmans in the dustbin. They're trained men. They should be better than this. So, we find the next stage, conventional explanations. Yes, yes, they weren't drunk, they're not cranks. They're nice blokes, honest blokes, quite trained, but they saw ice crystals in the sky, temperature inversions, high-flying geese, spots before the eyes, refraction of light, all the rest of the guff. And you know the rest of the tape, too. If we had more information, we've explained 99%, 98%, 27%, it varies. And if we had a little more information, the 0.01% or the 0.924% would be explained. We heard that for year after year. And all the big braid and all the big brass came on and told us it was ice crystals. And then that was it. Because it became exceedingly difficult to dismiss these flipping ice crystals which kept landing. 4,000 contacts, you were saying. I'd have put the figure about three, but why quibble? And all these people who began speaking, who said they'd been for a ride in. And again down came the prejudice. Without knowing the name of these people, without having read their stories, without having examined it, chuck them in a dustbin. I didn't go, therefore nobody else did. I didn't find out, and you didn't either, till I do it first. And we're at the last stage now. Open discussion, silence, ridicule, conventional explanations, all worn thin. All right, you did see a saucer, you weren't tight, it wasn't a balloon, or before, after 1957, a satellite. It was a saucer, but they're hostile. And now when you go to a meeting, everybody gets up and talks about heat rays and this and that. Ask yourselves two questions, my friends. One, why did nobody talk about hostile sources before 1967-8, when this propaganda beat started? They refer now to incidents earlier than 67-68. They're all being dug up and paraded around. But why weren't they paraded around before that time? Have you been looking for yourself, or have you been influenced by somebody else? Second question. Who, what, why, how, in 1954, caused those sources to go off the front pages of all the press, Chinese, Russian, American, English, Indian, a lot. These are incredible questions. There must be some sort of link. There must be some sort of reasoning somewhere. Because too many people and too much evidence. And since if you haven't had the direct evidence, you know, because I didn't see, go along to a library and look through some of the newspaper files in 1954. Take, say, 53 and 55 and see the difference. So there's more to sources than nuts and bolts. But nuts and bolts are very important. In fact, without them, we build on sand. And yet, Captain Howard saw the solid saucer and it changed shape. Those saucers are said to have landed in Edwards Air Force Base, became visible and invisible. Speakman became aware he was looking at an empty sky. 1952, Washington, D.C., most powerful city on the planet, perhaps, guarded by two radar stations, a military station, and fighters. Three consecutive nights, saucers come over Washington, forbidden area. They're seen visually and on the radar, plural sets. Fighters come up, see them visually and on their airborne radar, fourfold lock. Fighters approach, saucers withdraw. Fighters to Duran run out of fuel, land. Back come the saucers, refuel the fighters, back. This pantomime went on three consecutive nights, fourfold lock at a time. Visual, ground radar, ground visual, ground radar, airborne visual, airborne radar. And then the down sources, when this pantomime was going on over Washington, D.C., did weird things. You'd see them visually and not on radar. You'd see them on radar and not visually. You'd see both, you'd see none. You can't explain it. They're either on radar or they aren't. You either can see them or you can't. This is either a solid object or it isn't. Physics says so. And yet these darn sources, who come from wherever they do, let's come to that in a minute, but if there are 1,000 million planets there and somebody's 10% more advanced on a horse, that's about 800 millennia of Earth time, they don't seem to be stuck in nuts and bolts in three dimensions. And it seems stupid, if you'll pardon the word, just to put the head in the sand and say, it isn't so. Can't be. Because it is. The Howards and the Speakmans go on. The radar sets guarding Washington and the fighters proved it. They're sometimes visible by radar, not, sometimes visually, and not. Someone was saying, what sort of man sees a saucer? And I believe that's an interesting question. And I believe perhaps it's the next one. On the conventional nuts and bolts side, you've gone through the five stages and you're now at the stage of fear of the unknown, they're hostile. And we've had this all through. It's always their fault. The enemy in war, the boss in a trade union, the schoolmaster at school, the chap on the other, in the other house, their fault. And fear of hostility, and we project any subconscious act projected up. Couldn't possibly be the whole truth, could it? If they'd been here since the time of the pharaohs, which obviously they have, anybody who's studied sources knows they've been here. If they've been here since the time of Atlantis and Lemuria, 18 millions of years ago, if that's too unscientific and unproven for you, let's stick to the ancient Egyptians and the pyramids of the pharaohs. Everybody, however dense, will come along with that. They've been here, shall we say, 5,000-7,000 years. If they were hostile and had wanted to do all these things, why didn't we think of it before 1967-8, when this propaganda beat started? And what have we got now, improved on a bow and arrow, compared to the pharaohs? Did you remember that case when there's a missile rising from White Sands, New Mexico, the proving ground which now been displaced by Cape Canaveral? It's rising at a known speed, this missile, of 18,000 miles an hour. While it's rising, there are two radar stations tracking it, and Theodore team here as well. A saucer and the film unit. The film unit and the two radar stations record this. The saucer doing tight rings round a missile rising at a known speed of 18,000 miles an hour. Pulls of G, pulls of gravity, absolutely impossible in physics. And then the saucer accelerates away, leaving this thing virtually standing, although it's going up at a known speed of 18,000. And the team, with their instruments, gets the dimension of the saucer, 105 feet. So they've got a technology which is pretty good. And they seem to be able to make a solid object change. Now, is there any clue here for you and I, if we want to take it? The joy is, we don't have to take it. Who cares, for example, what I say? There's no authority behind it. No big brass, nothing. It's entirely up to the individual, you and I, as to whether we accept or reject. It's entirely free. There's no force. Now clearly, I'm coming off nuts and bolts. And clearly I'm going into what we're pleased to call subjective. And that very word sometimes sets up the hackles of some people. Yet, Shakespeare's poetry is subjective. It's very beautiful. We've been taught to appreciate it, and we clap, we'll accept that. In science, we've got two things round our neck: repeatability, observability. There are two tools with which we said we broke the superstitions of the past. But those tools of observability, repeatability, anybody can observe, anybody can repeat the experiment, given the conditions, might begin now to be hamstringing instead of two tools. You take the Wimbledon tennis champion. Today he plays beautifully. Tomorrow the same rackets, the same court, the same partners, the same conditions, he's off form. It's not observable, it's not repeatable. Why is he off form? You take any creative artist. Today the music is beautiful, the book is wonderful, the painting is marvelous. Tomorrow he's off form. Now we all know this is true. Observability and repeatability won't work. So we try the unknown, we try psychology, he's had a row with his wife or something like this. But it doesn't always work. Is there something more? Was it possible that Howard, when he said the solid object changed shape and the shapes he drew, was it possible that there's something more there for us to see? And this is the controversial thing I'd like to offer to you. But before I do it, let's take a couple of saucer contact cycles and look at them again. One is the very famous one everybody knows of George Adamski's first one in the desert. He meets this Venusian in this particular spot in the desert. The Venusian has special shoes on, draws Adamski's attention to the shoes, presses down into the sand, makes the imprint in the sand, and we've all seen plaster casts of them and so on. The imprints were deep enough for plaster casts to be taken off. The Venusian is about 5'8" in height, looks about 180 pounds in weight. Later, we took an earthling there, 5'8" in height, 180 pounds in weight, to the same spot, put rugger boots on his feet, you know, with big indentations on them, the rugger boots, and said, press into the ground and make a mark sufficiently deep for us to take a plaster cast. And the earthling of 180 pounds couldn't do it. He stamped, he jumped up and down, he couldn't make a mark sufficiently clear in the sand unless you poured water there. And there was no question in the original Adamski contact of water being put down before the imprint. So, said the nuts and bolts, there you are, that proves Adamski is a fraud. All right, let's leave it just for a sec. Take another one. That Mexican taxi driver, Salvador Medina. He breaks down his taxi about 300 miles north of Mexico City one afternoon, late afternoon. He has to spend the night in the saucer. The saucer people come, they contact him. I won't go into all the details, you know it. The point is, next morning, they say, we'd like to come and see our saucer. It's now daylight, and there it is, not very far away, and they start walking towards it, the two saucer people and Medina. Medina, being a good old, solid, dense, physical earthling, goes through this swampy thing, sinking in to his ankles as he goes, and the Venusians seem to just go over it like that. Now why? They go over the swamp and don't go in, and in the desert with Adamski, the Venusian can press down and make marks which the earthling can't. Solid objects change shape. What's the link? Have we got to get beyond nuts and bolts? Have we got to grow? Is our physics also of the horse compared to those planets, compared to another 800 millennia? What have we got to learn? First, are we going to look, or where has the unknown and the prejudice brought up the hackles? Where in that story of the 1947 sighting did you drop off? Why? Is that the spot that's now going to bring you up with a joke? Because if it is, we'll go round and round and round about radar and more sightings. And unproven. And anyway, what's it matter? If we can come a little more, it might matter very much to you and I and the other chap. It might matter very much to the planet, and we might have to do something very drastic. The thing we hate doing most, let's change ourselves. We're always happy to change the other bloke. It's his fault. We're quite happy with that. Shoot him, or educate him, put him in prison. But me? I'm fine, Jack. But now these dark sources want me to look at myself and let go of me physics. Now, this is the rub. And yet, Adamski's contact made himself heavy so that he can get in. And the Medina contact made himself light so that he didn't sink. Make yourself heavy make yourself light, solid object change shape. Have you ever heard, Mr. Chairman, of Eastern yoga? Everybody now in the West has heard it. 10 years ago, it was one of those as unproven as telepathy, which everybody now has heard of. One of the things yoga says, and I've seen it down on an English stage, there was a nice, attractive looking young girl, she goes on the stage, she invites up three great tough guys, lift me up, and they lift her up. And she does whatever it is she does, she makes herself heavy and they can't lift her up. And this is not one of those things you just label as hypnotism, which also one has seen. What is this Hatha Yoga, to give its technical jargon of the East? Now this is where the word subjective very much comes in. And this is the whole point of being able to talk freely without authority. What I say, nobody cares two hoots about. If it doesn't agree with what's most inside you, doesn't ring true to what's most inside you, chuck it out and he out, nobody cares. You're entirely free. But you might like to consider, what is it that's sitting on that chair, that thing called you? Well, it's your physical body. But that's not you. There's something inside that. There's a hell of a body inside that. Sometimes you're on firm as a Wimbledon champion, sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're radiant, sometimes you're drooping. People who talk about these untrue and silly things like aura say that if your rays are sticking out and fine and vibrant like that, the halo of a saint or something, the twice born of a Hindu, the son of initiation, any of these words, like that, your health body's fine. But that's not you. You've got some emotions. That we know. Who can't get into a first-class temper? On this, we're all absolutely the cat's whiskers. But that's not you. We've also got a mind. In fact, it might be this mind which has got you stuck in nuts and bolts and physics and making what I'm saying now so subjective and such nonsense. To be honest with you, there are only about three people at the moment who are looking at me as though I'm a complete twerp. The others are actually listening. Now, to the three people who look at me as though I'm such a twerp, who's the twerp? Why? Why can't you come along with the rest and listen? What's the blockage? Where in that story of 1947 did your blockage come? What is the gold medal you've got to let go if this story is true? Those are very real questions for us. This is the thing we hate. What have we got to choose to do? See, if I've got a degree in physics, or if I'm an authority of, or this very word, I, by itself, that selfish word, I, it might be the blockage. Let's go on a bit. So the thing sitting on the chair has got a physical body, a health body, an emotional body, and a mind body. What's using those four things sitting on a chair? Is that the real you? This is what that subjective yoga nonsense talks about. Unproven this is, and there are now more than three people with a sort of superior smile. What is this superior smile? Is that the defense mechanism of the period of ridicule after silence? Oh no, I'm not nuts. I didn't see a saucer. You saw a saucer. You were nuts. I'm all right. Fear of the unknown. Or a willingness to look. So what's using those four tools? Is that the real you? This is what is said in Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga. Now, if you accept this, and there are many people in the East who know it, and people in the West who know it, and there's some superb books in the West on it, and there are now in the West many societies for meditation, water. I don't mean the show-off act and the guru act, but the real stuff. What can happen, apparently, is this. This real inner you, which uses these four tools, has a consciousness which can come up and down the range. Most of us are stuck in the nuts and bolts, this physical thing. Many have had some instances of something beyond that, be it telepathy, be it a hunch, be it something. ESP is now not such a dirty word as it was. This sixth sense we're now talking about. And that means that this inner consciousness has dragged for a moment the main focus out of the physical into something else. You've had a beautiful experience or a wonderful inspiration of thought. Einstein got the formula and we've got the bomb. It took him ages when he got the formula to get it onto paper. It took 2 years, in fact. Beethoven, and then it took ages to get it down into a symphony. This consciousness, for a moment, flashed and then had to get its way through. Now, these lower things, dust to dust, ashes to ashes of the exoterics, if this consciousness works, you can add or subtract it. You can make yourself heavy like Adamski's man or light like Medina's man. And it's been done. People who think it can't be done and solid objects can't change shape and Howard was a fool. Why does a yogi sit on a mountain top in snow and ice and not get cold? Why does he walk across cold and not get burnt? The easy answer is, it's unproven, it didn't happen. Howard was a liar or a fool, and my physics are correct. The 1,000,000,000 planets out there, none of them are 10% more advanced than me. Maybe. Maybe we've got to look. Maybe sorcerers are trying to change us. Why have they been here since the Pharaohs and not landed at Hyde Park and shot up the Grenadiers? Come on, TV, come to our leaders, give us a blueprint for a better gun. I asked you last time I came, any Christians who are here, why wasn't Jesus, the Son of God, who came to help, so it is said in the official accounts, who should have had more sense, why wasn't he born, Caesar in Rome? That would have been the proper place to be born. Then the legions would have come round, it would have been proclaimed in the Capitol next morning, on Capitol Hill, and then the Forum, and that would have been it. Instead of that, born in the local salt mines. If you're a patrician in Imperial Rome, you've never heard of Judea. You had to look it up on a map. Born from below up carpenter's town. And you could accept or reject as you like. There were no legions there with big, big spears and whatnot to say this is. I don't know. Is there something of this? Why do the sources over Washington appear on radar, disappear, reappear, neither both? Why does Howard see? Why does the Adamski contact get heavy and the other one get light? Is there anything in this nonsense? Isn't this the way we do it? Look at us with sources. 10 years ago, we were all mad keen, and rightly mad keen, to get a radar report. get some triangulation of the height of the ice crystals, the five that Alec Birch photographed over Musra and Sheffield. According to the Air Ministry, they were ice crystal. They were 614 feet high, because in the photographs of the top of his trees, he got some triangulation of five of these Ford hub caps at 614 feet high, 28 feet each diameter. And the kid slung up these five 28 feet diameter Ford hub caps, 614 feet up, and took the photograph, and then they turned out to be ice crystals. You see, this was the sort of thing we were doing when he took that photograph in 1962. It's now nearly a decade later. And now let's look at Adamski's contact. Look at this solid object changing shape. Why does some bloke, this is where we started, see a saucer? Now, since we're talking subjective stuff, let me tell you something no stronger than a fairy story. I happen to believe it, but that just proves what a fool I am. Most people on this, in this village, planet Earth, have some vague idea of something called God or oneness or something. Whereas some of us are very clear what we think is our particular idea, and we're quite willing to shoot and kill the fellow who's got a different idea in another part of the village. But we'll all, most of us, even the Russians, I think, would accept that there's something which is, well, a bit difficult to explain. And a little bit difficult to sort of brush aside altogether, however scientific we are. And then we got these famous five senses. Why have we got five? Why haven't we got 22? In which order did you get five? What's this sixth sense stuff that we're talking about, which is so unproven? Story goes, from the oneness to manifestation down here. So-called spirit, so-called matter. Downward into manifestation, the involutionary arc coming down. Back in return, the evolutionary arc going back to oneness. And it's done in seven great brute races, says my fairy story. The seven planes of consciousness, these four tools and the inner three that you use. You first step from the oneness out into differentiation, the first sense of hearing. In the exoteric religions, in the beginning was, and we've all heard it. Not going into details, it may or may not be right, other religions have a different viewpoint. But they all say, hearing. Second, a bit more densified down, touch. It's now solid enough too. And it's still sort of all over. Third, root race, and all the exoteric religions are fall of man. All of them. Not just any one particular religion. We happen to be in this continent with this civilization. We might easily be speaking at Damascus, there are millions of people there, or at Delhi, there are millions there, or in Africa, and they've all got the fall of man into matter. The third root race, where spirit and matter meet, you and I get a sort of body, and we get our third sense, that of sight. We can begin to focus. I can look there and focus on it. Look at it clearly instead of just an all-around glimpsing like this. Fourth root race, more matter than spirit, densification down in all the exoteric religions again, the story of the floods, the story of evil and good and all the rest of it, and we get our fourth sense, that of taste. And now the body is tightening down. That Lemurian one, 18 million years ago, the third root race, loose, inchoate thing, about 27 feet tall. And we'll just remember that in passing, and we'll come back to flying saucers to it in a minute, in some other context. The Atlantean one said to be, and laughed at by the nuts and bolts states, who were mad keen on a Minoan civilization in Crete somewhere in the Mediterranean, said to be 4 millions of years ago, and we tightened the body down to about 12, 15, 10 feet over that period of time. It lasted from 4 millions to 1 million. All this is a fairy story. I'm not putting it stronger because obviously one or two hackles are up. Fifth root race. Now, you and I. A peach of a body, absolutely tightened down, most responsive, completely different from that loose, inchoate one or the Atlantean one. This thing, and our fifth sense, that of smell. And we've come from oneness down here, about as far from oneness as we can. Most of us deny very much the very existence of spirit or psychic or what have you. It's all fairy tale nonsense, and we worship the new god, matter. We call it science, and a solid object can't shape, change shape, and Howard is a fool. And that's today. And yet, in our inner beings, very few of us really are satisfied just with matter. Even if we've got a private aeroplane which will go and photograph or see these sources of Mount Rainier, if we've got our Bentleys and we've got everything, in the end, we're not really quite enough. Man doesn't really live by bread alone. And we've got this yearning of something more. Whatever you call it, God or whatever. This quality of the sixth root race, this sixth sense, back towards oneness, and then the seventh, and back here. This arc downwards is the arc of selfishness and the word I. And you can whistle. This arc is of oneness. And then beings like the Jesus, for example, or the Buddha, or Zoroaster, or Truth, or Osiris, or any of them, who come to give, who don't arrange to be born Caesar in Rome. And these beings don't seem to bargain. You and I give a tea party, and we're happy to have the cakes eaten, but we expect to be asked back. And when we are asked back, we mentally count the chocolate eclairs. We bargain. But what did the Christ, for example, come to take? Now, the bloke who sees saucers, is he of this involutionary arc of selfishness, and therefore has to have proof, has to have authority, therefore relies on authority? Or of this evolutionary art where he gives, where there's more of a oneness than separation, where there's more love than hate, and more response. And then he'll be getting out of these four bodies into this. He'll be talking of God, if you like, or of Krishna, the beloved, or Allah, the compassionate, or whatever it might be. Or of the psychic oneness or what have you. But it'll be out of the nuts and bolts. Is it not possible that some of these 1,000 million planets who were 800 millennia advanced on us in Earth time, if they're only 10% in the vast, were 80 millions of years, 10% in 8 million years, have come to this and have a knowledge of this thing? And to them, solid objects don't change shape. If you're focusing in the inner three and you've got these four, this you can alter. and the stories of it being visible and invisible, on radar and off radar, getting heavy, getting light, begin to make some sort of sense. If they did land at Edwards Air Force Base, and you were able to walk through, and then you weren't able to walk through, and if over the radar at Washington, D.C., they were seen and weren't seen, it begins to have a story. Now, this might mean a great change in you and I. And the joy is that who cares what I say? If it rings true, is this the sort of bloke who sees sources on the evolutionary arc? It's got nothing to do with his outer job. He can be a sailor at sea with a horizon all round. He can be stuck in a prison and he looks out of the prison bars and he sees the stars. This bloke will see the mud when he looks out. Now, this is very subjective. I just threw away in passing that Lemurian loose body, and I said I'd bring it back to sources. And to finish, I'll do that. The source of contacts. There are many of them, thousands, I do agree, and at many, many levels. Let's take one bloke and one example of the many levels. It's a man called Angelucci. You know of him. He's an Italian-American. He had a lot of physical pain. A lot of physical pain. The bloke on the involutionary arc, the selfish bloke, then that pain, they get inward turned. Everything happens to me, and it's somebody else's fault. And they get bitter, and they get sour. Evolutionary arc pain, the chap on the cross, for example, he didn't get bitter or sour, so it is said. And you get upward turned in oneness of this thing. And Angelucci was of the evolutionary arc. The pain had made him responsive in the artistic sense, alert sense. In other words, he was conscious if you were thinking I was a twerp or were listening. Because both I had. He was conscious. There was a certain amount of flow between relationship, oneness with some words. These sixth sense, these new age qualities, this return arc of love and oneness was beginning to have some meaning. Comes 1946 and he sees two lights in the sky. The expression flying saucers has not yet been popularized. There's not yet a peg on which to hang all our sightings. The Romans call them flying shields. The Christians in the Bible call them flying wheels and things in the fires in the sky, pillars of, all sorts of things. We haven't got a common peg to tag it on. Angelucci just sees two lights in the sky, 1946. Years go by, about 1952 in fact. 47 has come, the expression has been born, flying saucers, and at once he's remembered. Those who were here when I just came in were telling the stories of the saucers they'd seen. Once you've seen it, you do remember the damn thing. It etches itself on the memory. You could describe, if it was a year ago or 3 years ago, you could describe the details, nearly always. But 2 days before, or 2 days afterwards, you couldn't tell me whether it was raining then, probably. Why does it etch into you when you've seen a saucer? And sometimes you want to talk about it to everybody. You can't stop the bloke telling you about his sighting. And there's the other one who won't talk. Who feels somehow it sort of kind of degrades it. Who's very loath to talk about it. involution, evolution. I don't know which way they go. That it etches on is the thing that worries me. And it says time, that's the next question I'll come back to. But we're dealing with this loose kabod. Angelucci has two lights, he's had his pain, he's outward turn, and in 1952 he gets his first contact. And the first contact, as is so often the case, is preceded by telepathy. Over and over again you get telepathy. He gets this telepathic impulse, he's driving his car at night, he drives it into a deserted road. He stops, his headlights are still on. In front of his car headlights are two whirling lights. They emerge into a kind of a television screen. He gets out of his car, leans against the radiator. Onto the screen is projected a face, and there's a, inverted commas, conversation. Subjective and the not proven to those who weren't stuck in these lower forms. A little while goes by, he gets the telepathic impulse again. And this time he goes down to a riverbed. It's a misty day. Shimmering through the mist comes tall, loose, inchoate body, just like this Lemurian, with the same face attached to it, and they have a conversation. More time goes by. He's at the local Greyhound bus station, Angelucci, with his family. Nice, dense physique. He sees now this face in a body like yours and mine, tight down here, just like this, wearing conventional earthing clothes. And Angelucci is going to rush to this chap too. And he gets telepathic impact back, don't draw attention to me. He doesn't, and the spaceman holds open the glass door of the railway station. The spaceman is dense physical enough to hold open the door. The family goes through. The family say to Angelucci, what's the matter with you? What's in here? He says, nothing, nothing, nothing. The other contacts have been spaced a bit apart. The very next day, the spaceman calls on Angelucci and says, thank you for not drawing attention to me. They both go into a cafe and they both drink coffee and they both talk good American. The point of the story, whichever level of contact the earthling can take, whichever of these four he can get to, it's met. Including the dense physical, if you can't get out of nuts and bolts. The health body, that shimmering thing, a mental projection, that thing in front of him. All right, this is subjective, this is unproven, this is trite, and Howard, when he said solid object change shape, was a fool. Or there's something there for those who have eyes to see.